Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, we'll be chatting with Emily Maxwell and Nathan Sartori, and the Disability Collective. So, if you could introduce yourselves and tell me a little bit about the Disability Collective.
Yeah, so I'm Emily Maxwell, and I am the founder and one of the co-directors of the Disability Collective.
And I'm Nathan Sartori, and I am the other co-director.
The Disability Collective is a not-for-profit organization that is dedicated to celebrating and showcasing disability in the arts.
So, would that include cross types in terms of visual art, stage productions, that sort of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. We're really dedicated to, you know, expanding what we're including as art. So yeah, visual art. Both Emily and I are from performing arts background, but we've also included culinary arts in the past. Writing. Really anything you can think of.
So in terms of the disabilities themselves, what do you hope to get across? Clearing up some of the myths concerning disability, for example?
Absolutely. I think there are a lot of stereotypes that are that surround disability, and that's something we really hope to break down. But we also think that disabled artists have a really unique perspective on life and the world. And part of our goal is to share these unique perspectives with people because I think it's really important. I think these stories need to be told. I think these perspectives deserve to be shared. And that's something that we're hoping to accomplish.
So can you give me an overview of some of the performances and various art types you've used previously?
Sure. So we just launched at the beginning of this year, 2021. So far we've done three events with our fourth project right now on the horizon. The first was our inaugural event, which was a showcase. So we were looking for, again, artists of any type. And that included, again, visual arts and culinary arts and lots of performances. And we put it into an online showcase event to kind of launch the Disability Collective. Following that, we did an online cooking class with a disabled chef. And most recently, we did a screening of a soundscape short film and a Q&A and discussion with the artist.
Are there any particular techniques you use, such as sign language interpretation, in the work?
I mean, in the work itself, that's up to the individual artist whether they want to include it as part of the piece. But regardless of that, whenever we're hosting an event that showcases art, we want to make it as accessible as possible. So for the showcase, we did have two ASL interpreters for the event. For the most recent screening we did, ASL interpretation was included in the artwork itself. So that worked out well in our favor. But we always try to make sure our events are as accessible as possible, and so we, you know, have live captioning available. We always make sure that we're using image descriptions and alt text on everything on our social media. And we listen to what our community tells us, and we're very grateful that lots of people communicate with us about what their access needs are, and that can help us make things more accessible for everyone else going forward.
So, how do you go about reaching out to the disability population?
Sure. So when we first started, we're using a lot of different ways to try and reach out to our community. A lot of that through, of course, social media, but also a lot of it was, you know, really going out and finding those people, you know, whether that be in Facebook groups, for example, or posting it in as many places as we can. In Canada, we have the wonderful Creative Users Network, who is a great resource for any disabled artists. We're really grateful for them and their help in supporting us. We've really, you know, expanded our reach over the past 6 months. And so our Instagram has grown very substantially, and we're grateful that we have a lot of supporters. But at the beginning, it sure did take, you know, some digging to find the artists that we know they were out there. But especially when we're dealing with so many different kinds of art, it's not like everyone's really looking into one place. We had to go in and find where people were, you know, chatting and showing off their art.
So, in your time with the collective, has there been any success story that stands out for you?
I mean, I think that the thing that we consider to be the most successful is just how we've been able to engage with the community. There's so many folks who have said to us, we've been waiting for something like this to exist for a really long time. And that has been a real driving force for us. We've been able to work with a lot of different artists and provide some artists with different opportunities and connect some artists together so that they can work on new projects with each other. That's what is so exciting about this is the community aspect of it. And it's pretty clear that the disabled community want to connect and want to work together and want to create together. And it's been really amazing.
So if you could send any message to the community about the need for inclusion in arts and equality in that sense, what would you say?
Good question. like I said earlier, both Emily and I come from a theater background, and just from our own personal experiences, there is certainly a lack of awareness surrounding disability and a lack of representation. And so, I mean, that was one of the main reasons we started the Disability Collective, is to create that space that seems to not exist. Yes. We're really, really, you know, driven to making disability inclusion something that is, you know, seen everywhere when you're seeing art and isn't something that we have to hide or be afraid to share, and should be something that we can celebrate.
I also think it's important to note that we recognize that disability has a different impact on folks who are at the intersection of other marginalized communities as well, and something that we're hoping to discuss within the disabled community is how we can have a positive impact within our own community to uplift other marginalized folks as well, and that's something that we try to accomplish and are always trying to work towards and make sure that that's something that we focus on with everything we do.
Like, thank you both for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure, yeah.
In this segment of our show, Michael Klonowski will be telling us a little bit about wheelchair rugby. So, can you tell me a little bit about the Rugby Association?
Sure. So the United States Wheelchair Rugby Association was formerly known as the United States Quad Rugby Association. We just recently, in the last year, changed our name to be more inclusive for all individuals that play our sport. But we've been around since the late 80s, and we're a Paralympic sport. We are the domestic governing body for the sport, so we have 44 teams, about 500 athletes, and we love to play rugby.
So when it comes to quad rugby in particular, are there any myths or stereotypes that you found about a person's ability to actually participate in the sport?
So I think a lot of folks, when they first hear about wheelchair rugby, they hear about individuals with quadriplegia, which can have many different faces. It can be part of any different type of diagnosis, whether it's a spinal cord injury, cerebral palsy, amputation, other neurologic impairments. And people come to our tournaments and they say, hey, those guys and gals are pushing their own chairs. How do they do that? They expect folks to have no ability to move their arms and legs, and they're amazed by how much people are able to accomplish with, you know, sometimes no function in their legs or trunk and minimal in their arms. And I think it's just something you have to see in person to really understand. And a lot of people have not seen our sport in person.
So how do you go about reaching out to the disability community to let them know this is an option for them?
So a lot of folks recruit in different ways to get players on their teams and also to get people involved in the sport. So our organization, our team, the Chicago Bears, we have a hospital that we work with. And so sometimes when folks are coming out of a tough time after an injury or something, we introduce them to the sport. Sometimes it's just word of mouth. Sometimes people talk to each other or see videos or see the movie Murderball, and that's what pulls them in. They see something that is just incredibly cool, and they want to be a part of it.
So what types of modified equipment do you use?
So the chairs themselves are pretty interesting tools. There's two different types of chairs. There's high point chairs or offensive chairs and low point chairs or defensive chairs. The offensive chairs are, I guess you could say, similar to something you would see in wheelchair basketball. However, it has this metal plating or wings in front of the wheels to kind of bowl over whoever is in their way. And then the low point chairs have a like an outrigging, which is called a picker, and a defensive player or a lower functioning athlete can use that picker to stop other chairs and to take advantage of a situation if they're in the proper position. So every chair is a little bit different because every person is different. Your chair setup will make the difference between having a good time out there and being very competitive or just being stuck on the court and having a lot of trouble getting involved. So very different stuff. But there's also like different types of gloves. Some people use weightlifting belts in order to secure themselves in their chairs so that even if they don't have much trunk control, they can still be very, very competitive on the floor. So every person has different adaptations that they make, and when people figure it out, you can tell the difference.
So what about the playing surface itself?
So the playing surface itself is a basketball court. the dimensions are pretty much identical. The only difference is that there's a defensive area or a key around each goal at the ends. So if you're going from basket to basket in basketball, you're actually going from goal to goal or try to try on the ends of the court. And you have to pass through the two cones at each end to score a point. So you have to have possession of the ball, and you have to get two wheels across, and then the point or the try counts.
So in your time with the sport, is there any success moment that stands out for you?
Success that stands out?
Yes.
So I think it was 2018. My local team, the Chicago Bears, did very well that year. We had a great squad, and for the first time in almost 15 years, we made it to nationals. I think that any time that you have an opportunity to see the best of the best at nationals, you're going to see some really special games. And I remember the national championships each year that I've been there, and that final game is just incredible. So those are moments that stick out to me. Whether it was my team or not, it was very, very exciting.
So what message would you send to the community about the need for inclusion in sport?
So I would say that it's really, really, really important. Competition and camaraderie are huge for any individual, whether you have a physical or intellectual disability. You know, just being a part of something bigger than yourself and contributing positively to a team's effort is incredibly fulfilling. Sometimes folks, you know, don't have that competitive side, and sometimes people are just waiting for that opportunity to show what they really are capable of doing, and that's what adaptive sports do. They give you a chance to be on a level playing field with your peers and to compete at the highest levels.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Yeah, sure, no problem at all.
If you or someone you know is struggling with mental health or addiction, consider registering to the new REACT program launched by Downtown Windsor Community Collaborative. REACT is a 90-day program committed to understanding your story and supporting your journey to healthy and long-term healing. All sessions are online and completely free, running weekdays from 9 a.m. until noon. Visit reactwindsor.ca and instantly be connected to a safe and supportive community. That's reactwindsor.ca.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard a little bit about the Disability Collective from Emily Maxwell and Nathan Sartori, and a little bit about wheelchair rugby from Michael Kolanowski. This segment of our show, Catherine Kudlick will be telling us a little bit about the Paul K. Longmore Institute on Disability. So, can you tell me a little bit about the Institute's work?
So, the Paul K. Longmore Institute on Disability is at San Francisco State University, and it's, I guess, the easiest way to describe it is it's a disability cultural center of sorts. But we, bring together students, scholar activists, others in the community to create a place where people can learn about disability and disabled people from the perspective that the world is better because of disabled people. So instead of doing pity or feel good inclusion, the idea is to show real resilience and really thought-provoking, interesting stories and to engage people in ways around disability that they don't typically have a chance to do.
So how do you go about reaching out to the disability population to let them know about your work?
You know, there's a lot of social media. That's the main way. You know, we started small. I mean, we're still small. We're just 1.5 people. So we have a pretty mighty roar for the small size that we have, but we work with students, so that kind of expands. We started small, so we were just basically doing campus in the San Francisco Bay Area. But then, you know, especially under, you know, lockdown, more and more people, you know, found out about us because we pivoted to doing online programming. And so that's probably how you heard and others have heard about us, is that, you know, social media is this megaphone that amplifies events, and, you know, there's good parts of that and not so good parts about that, but we really benefited from the good parts where, you know, you reach out to communities through social media networks. We have campus communities that share with friends or, you know, all of that. But honestly, the past year or two has mostly been online.
So when you mentioned about looking at a more balanced perspective on disability life, how do you go about clearing up some of the myths about what should be in place, such as we should include people because, oh, we need to do that as a public image thing or what have you?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. One of the main ways, we do it through, you know, there's that famous saying, show, don't tell, really. So we try not to be too preachy about it. But, you know, we host the Superfest Disability Film Festival every October. And it's the world's longest-running disability film festival. And we kind of started by showing, by telling people about the fact that, you know, you're going to see films you won't see anywhere else. And we talk about Disability 101, which is, you know, disabled people are people too, and isn't that great, and kumbaya, and all of that. And then we see that Disability 201 adds a little twist to it, or a big twist, I should say. And that says, you know, first of all, you want to make sure that the disabled person is at the center of the story, that they're the ones that are creating the story, they're the ones that are sharing the insights. You also want to show them interacting with more than one other disabled person or another disabled person, so that it's not just, you know, the non-disabled person learning about that person's disability. It's actually about community and about building connections. And then another way is to think about the intersections, the really important intersections with other pieces of disability that form our identity. So, you know, LGBTQ, people of color, all sorts of, you know, different kind of modes that we operate in as humans, to think about our existence as not just being about our disability, and yet not saying we're living despite our disability. We're who we are because of our disabilities, and that brings great, great creativity, great innovation, kind of working flexibly with systems that aren't designed for us. And in our film festival and in our other events, we try to highlight instances where people with disabilities are making this happen.
That's the thing, though. People with disabilities tend to be their own best advocates. It starts with them knowing that they should have equal inclusion and then asserting that. I mean, it's a lot of cases a person just kind of gets tossed a turkey bone, I think. Sort of a pity inclusion or things like that. Glad to see that you're working to tear down some of those walls. Now,
yes.
In your time doing this work, is there any success moment stands out for you?
Oh, wow. It's not just one moment. It's many, many moments. But let me give, I'll just give one, but there's so many. We did an exhibit a few years ago called Patient No More, People with Disabilities Securing Civil Rights. And in the United States in 1977, the disabled people had basically no rights. There was no kind of law in place. And for people that have seen the movie Crip Camp, you'll know this story. We told about it before that film was made, but more than 150 people with disabilities occupied a federal building in San Francisco for over a month, demanding civil rights for disabled people and anti-discrimination. And they won. They eventually through a series of efforts, and it's a more complex story, but people with disabilities were able to craft and then help get past the Americans with Disabilities Act, which is a pretty far-reaching civil rights legislation. It still needs more work, but it's getting there someday. But anyway, we did this exhibit about this amazing moment in 1977, and it was called the 504 occupation because there was this one little clause in this law that was being negotiated in 1977 that basically somebody snuck in language that would help eliminate discrimination against disabled people. I forget how many words, but it's like 35 words or something, real small, whatever, but it had huge implications and nobody quite understood that yet. And so that was one of the reasons they occupied this building, to get this clause passed and so that it would basically end discrimination. So anyway, this Section 504 and the law itself passed, and the service provisions to all sorts of kids and people that were seeking accommodations for their disabilities were called 504 accommodations because of this little piece of the legislation. And so now, American kids go to school and they get their 504s, they get their, and it's this shorthand for an accommodation that they basically assume is handed down from the government. So our exhibit went to, we showed it in schools and in different places in the country, and it's traveling around still. And a group of students were in there, and they come and they look, and we give them a little treasure hunt to find things in the, in the exhibit that interest them and all sorts of things. And this one kid got very quiet, and he suddenly just was beaming, and he said, something? I've had a 504 accommodation my whole life. I thought it was just a bureaucratic number. And I realized that 150 people occupied a building so that I could have rights. And this is amazing. And this kid, held his head, high. He was like, this is an amazing moment. And all of his peers were learning the lesson right next to him. And he became, I think, in his own mind and probably the others, this really different person that was grounded in history, who was powerful, who was part of something much bigger than pity and much bigger than some mandated law that needed to take care of a person.
Mike, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
My friends, the story of occupying the federal building just to ask for equal rights, something I can't get away from. My mind keeps playing it out over and over again, asking the same question. How can it be we can look at our fellow human beings, tell them their rights are anything less than our own? We are all valued members of the community, something to contribute, something to give. If we don't recognize the potential in one another, how can we expect anyone to recognize the potential in us? It's a conundrum. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal, So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.